As some of you may know, we have a regular export finance podcast, which TXF runs. And Alfonso, I don't know if you have the picture for that. It includes Simon, Gabby, and myself. You say we're from this room here, we broadcast to literally millions of export finances on a regular basis. But what it does mean is we tend to have quite good flowing discussions, and hopefully we can get some of this across. But we wanted to have a special guest for our final session, which is Mr. Topi Vasteri as well. So I'll introduce the panel. Topi Vasteri is Finvira and also president of the Bern Union, able to give an ECA perspective. Simon Jones, and if we can have the other slide back now, Alfonso, that'd be great.
Please.
Yeah. Simon Jones with TD Securities, Simon Sayer with Deutsche Bank, and Gabby Buck with GKB Ventures and the British Banking Association. So, okay. Well, basically, this session is on how we can make export finance more accessible. It's a topic that I think we've tried to push throughout some of the conference as well. And so I'll start with you, Simon Sayer. Does export finance have either an image or a visibility problem?
All right, thank you for starting with me. Hi everyone, I'm really relieved there's more people in the audience than on the panel for this last session, which is great. I thought there was a serious risk of there not being, so. Look, I think yes. I think the very fact that you've asked that question suggests that the business probably does have an image problem. I'm always a little bit uncomfortable when we get defensive as a business. This, I always describe structured trade and export finance or export finance as a team sport, but it is a minority sport. There aren't many of us doing it. It's always been a bit of a niche. I think one of the reasons that it's a niche is, frankly, it's not a scalable business. We don't just generate deals out of thin air. These are real transactions going on around the globe, and there is a finite supply of deals that fit the export finance model. So we can't just go out and hire more people to make more money. There is a right size for the business, and the right size is determined by what's going on in the global economy, the trade finance world, and then the finance world, because we are about a business that provides finance to buyers of equipment. The other thing is the business is a little bit antiquated in so much that it's been around for quite a while. UKEF, I were here, they started in 1919, Exim started in the 1930s. So the business has been with us for an awfully long time, and I think that in some respects it has failed to reinvent itself, with one major exception. And this is the financial crisis, which started 10 years ago, and it was a business that reinvented itself. It was a shot in the arm. The business developed light years in just a few years. There were new products, new ideas. It became vastly more relevant to the international marketplace and to the bank's clients. And I think that was the point at which there was a little bit of an inflection for export finance as a business. And it's become a very exciting place to be in. And what we need to do is continue that momentum that was gained during the financial crisis to ensure that it's a product that continues to reinvent itself and realign itself to today's needs.
Okay, so no image, well, some image problem. The best thing about export finance was the financial crisis. This is maybe a statement.
It's a funny thing to say, but look, what it brought home was our business has a social impact, it's client-oriented, it's developmental, it's task and solutions-oriented, and that's a very rewarding place to be.
Yeah, okay.
No news is no news. So it's a very gray business. We don't really hear. It's not too sexy in terms that it doesn't cause the banks any huge big losses. Also, the ECAs have been able to manage their risks well enough, so we don't make the headlines. So therefore, we are not that well known.
Okay. And Simon Jones, any comments on that? And by the way, feel free to interrupt each other at any time.
I do that later.
Especially when I'm talking, Gabby will interrupt. No, I concur, of course, with everything Simon, Sayer and Topi have just said. I think the financial crisis did cause a big shake-up. Totally agree. And I think it probably was the best thing, a wake-up call to both the banks and the agencies and the market. But I think in the analysis of is it does it have a problem? It's certainly very niche, Gruber Simon. It uses long-term liquidity. They're following the crisis, there have become new issues like regulatory issues affecting balance sheet, KYC, AML, etc. So there are a fairly long list of negatives. But I think there are positives as well. Positives we're now seeing, as Simon said, the clients need it. It's generally high quality within the banks, and if you can maintain that position, that's not always easy, but it's so niche, you certainly have to push forward the positive aspects of the business and being high quality. ECA teams don't generally make a lot of losses. Today, there's a much broader use, partly because of the crisis, but there's a much broader use of export credit in the markets. It's not just the emerging markets. There's more use in the OECD. It's now seen as a gap filler more regularly in the OECD markets, whether it's the US or Australia or Spain or Italy. Not traditional markets, but corporates are using it as a diversity. And also they're recognizing that given the volatility, the increased volatility we've seen since the crisis, there was a pretty benign period between 2000 and 2007, but pretty volatile for various reasons, some of them not always connected since that time, which has meant that volatility has crept into the markets, and the markets are not necessarily always going to be there. So big borrowers have learned that just in case it does rain, and the financial markets are dislocated, there's no bond market, there's no syndicated loan market, there's no domestic market, maybe. They're using export credit more and more. And in banks, it now fits various models. It fits distribution models and lending models. So there are some banks that want to lend, okay, it fits their models. There are some banks that are not so keen on lending and they want to arrange and advise, and it can also fit those models now as well. And more importantly, something I've come across increasingly over the years is how major capex involves the strategic decisions of some of your major clients, and therefore the product, although very niche, and not used as much as the capital markets maybe or the syndicated loan markets, It can give clients access, can give banks access to clients at the most senior levels as well. So I think there are also some very positive sides to export finance.
And to your point about needing export finance when it rains, by the way, guys, absolutely bucketing with rain out there. So it's, you know, you're much, much better in here with us. Unfortunately, not really. No. Gabby.
I think it has a huge image problem. I think that... we've made this so complicated that it's difficult for banks to kind of really understand what export finance is all about. You know, we even have our own, it's like a religion. You know, we've even created our own version of the Bible. We've got the OECD rules, and if you look at, you know, chapter 1, verse 2, you know, we've got the definition of our original sin, that this is a gentleman's agreement, and you know, you mustn't go wrong. We've become so insular about the rules and regulations that it is very difficult for the market as a whole outside of ECA to really understand why we've made this so complicated. I remember once I had a lawyer come in to join me, Richard Wilkins, who's now at JP Morgan, and he once described this business in 6 words. You know, it's a loan with a guarantee. And at the end of the day, that is what the export credit agency business is about, but we've made it our own little world that is full of rules and regulations, that has become there's more bickering about those rules and regulations than actually doing the business.
I'm smiling at you, Gabby, because you're this is so funny.
Well,
no, hang on, I've got a funny story.
All right, okay.
When Gabby started working at Barclays with me, after about a week, he came to me and he said he'd come from the credit part of Barclays for EMEA, so doing difficult risk emerging markets. He said, so tell me this, Simon. He said, so we do a loan to a customer in Africa or Turkey or Mexico or wherever, and the UK government gives us a 100% guarantee. I said, yep, that's pretty much it. He said, That's pretty simple, isn't it? So, I think, Gabby, we are all guilty of making it more complex and mystifying it to keep ourselves in a job.
Yeah, I mean, you run with the flow, and and you can make profitability about the business, but the image issue...
Can't we change it into a positive thing? So, you know, we are the good guys, we do the health check, you know, we check that the environmental issues are right, social issues are right, we know the customer, and this and that. I think it's we are the good guys.
Yeah, don't get me wrong. Look, you know, I love this business. You know, I've traveled the world. I've done transactions in every sector that you could ever imagine. I've met really interesting people. It's a very dynamic business. I've never done two transactions the same. But we have made it really complex. It's really difficult for banks to attract new people because they just don't understand what this market is about. And so I think if, you know, when we talk about image, that's the problem.
Okay.
The problem is we made it too complex and we need to simplify it if we want to improve the image that we do.
Okay, so how would you attract new talent to the industry? What is the pitch and what type of people should the industry be looking to attract?
Well, I think you have to make it mainstream. I think that and that's the role of the export credit agencies as the banks. They've got to simplify. They've got to be able to churn and process the proposals in a much more timely manner. It's difficult to get a young person to come into this business and say, look, you could be working on this transaction and it may close in 2 years' time. You know, that is not really going to be attractive. And you look at the volumes that they do in comparison to working in the bond market or working in the loan market or working even in project finance. You know, that where there is less rules and regulations is more about the commercial reality. That's what's attracting people into the business. It's not...
So I've got a slightly different viewpoint on this, and I think we as a tendency have a tendency to increase the self-importance of our business, and I think it actually is not a complicated business. I think it is a very simple business, and I think that is one of the image problems. I think one of the reasons people have a view on export finance is because they just think it is so simple that who would really want to spend a career lending money with a guarantee? But when they come and work in the business, and when they come and see actually the complexities, the intricacies, the nuances, the way the financing works, and I think this is really key for millennials and the younger generation, social impact, developmental aspects, the international nature of the business, that's when the excitement really takes hold. And it becomes a much, much brighter picture for attracting new talent into the business. And that's certainly true for the juniors we have on our team.
I think so too. I think if you can get the graduates in after their rotation, not necessarily in their first job, in their second job, but show them the end result early, show them what it means to deliver an aircraft or see a ship launch or touch a telecoms infrastructure project in Malawi or whatever it is. You know, these guys, it just feels exciting. And if you're working in a single environment. It's got a fantastic international appeal.
I would agree with the Simons here. So because we find it very easy to recruit young people
because it must be slightly different to the ECA.
We have a purpose, and you know what they say, that it's much better to come and work for an ECA than work for a bank, because in an ECA you can still do something, still take some risk.
What type of people are you looking for? Is it the same people you were looking for 10 years ago, or has it changed, or do you expect it will do?
We are mainly recruiting, you know, young people who majored in finance, and I think, you know, when you get them on board, they are burning for doing the real thing because they know everything in theory, but they're not really done any financing. In a concrete sense.
I think, coming back on Gabby's point, I think it used to be the type of place in banks a while ago, not now, but in the sort of early 80s, when we all started. It was an area where bankers used to do whatever the job they did, and then they ended up in the export credit department when there were no real use anywhere else. And it was full of a little bit of dead wood.
Speak for yourself.
Gabby...
But the point I want to make more than anything else is about relevance. And we don't, you know, why we have an image problem, I go back to the data that we presented the other day. When you've got 20 names, the exporters that account for 61% of the volume of the business. And then on the buyer side, you've only got 9 names who in the last 4 years have issued ECA debt on a year-by-year basis. That's the image problem we've got. And so all the other aspects, the soft aspects about, you know, social infrastructure, about, you know, seeing real, tangible support for, cross-country trade, I get all of that. And it's really, really a dynamic industry. But we're only hitting a very small population in this business. And that, I think, and I'm reaching out not just to this lot, who I'm not gaining anything, but to the market as a whole, we've got to change that. Otherwise, this religion will just kind of get very, very narrow.
And okay, so taking that, which is effectively, and it's an origination point as much as anything. So, I mean, Simon Sayer, in your experience, I mean, how much of that origination challenge is communicating with borrowers and exports, and how much of it is actually, communicating internally with relationship managers or whoever it is to get your product out there?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And another thing that's happened in the last few years in our institution, I think in other institutions as well, is that we are much better integrated into the infrastructure of the bank. And we used to spend a lot of time doing our business ourselves because it was too complex to explain to an RM, or because it was a little bit nuanced and probably they didn't want to go and spend a week in Lusaka. So we are much better integrated post-crisis. And why? Because the product has become more relevant to clients that are relevant to the rest of the bank. That's part of doing business in developed markets as well as emerging markets. And it's the increased focus on supporting our clients and ensuring that we provide a valuable service to our clients that's made us more relevant. And I'll just tell you a funny story about the way we got our relationship managers more interested in us as a product. One of the challenges we have is that our deals are over very long periods. Sometimes they can be 15 or 16 years. And they earn money, but over a 15 or 16 year period. And most of our RMs want to talk about what sort of money's coming through the door now. So we made a shift in the way we incentivize relationship managers to look at us as a product. And instead of saying you look at the revenue that comes in every year, look at the total revenue that comes in over that 15 year period on an NPV basis, and that will be the way you'll be rewarded for selling us as a business. And suddenly deals that were making 50,000 a year or 100,000 a year were making 5 million or 10 million or double digits on an NPV basis. And almost overnight, RMs just couldn't get enough of us. You know, they see RM selling a deal, how do I get a piece of that? And suddenly it became a very, very popular product for RMs to get engaged in.
We got to find ways of incentivizing the whole industry to be able to speed up the delivery. Because the product is a great product, but we've got to find ways of getting it to market quicker.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, Toppy, on this origination question, obviously you come at it from a slightly different angle, because I guess a lot of it, from your perspective at Finvira, is actually educating sort of domestic exporters to understand more about what you've got, and also speaking about, from your Bern Union point of view, seeing how other ECAs have sort of faced that challenge of trying to sort of spread the web. And I guess that's a lot of that's an SME question, but not exclusively an SME question. I mean, how have you sort of...
When I first joined Finvira, I joined from a bank. I had a commercial banking background. I came up with the decision that wherever we are lending more than 50 million, you know, we really need to meet the management of the company and visit the company. Okay, then in the end we couldn't really do that, 50 million. So we raised the barrier, maybe 250 million. Then we're going to meet the management of the company. And I remember the first times going to the Philippines, for instance, see the telecom operators. They were telling that, wow, you are the first ECA that I ever saw alive. So, this is now, I think, very common that we go together with our exporters, see the clients, and explain the opportunities. And, you know, once we've done the first deal, they start to love us, and they want to do second and a third deal. That's with the sort of the borrower side. Then, of course, with the mid-cap and the SME clients, you have to really be holding their hand a lot. And we started training program. So we are not only training the mid-cap companies who are exporting, but we are also training the account officers in the banks that serve these mid-cap companies, so they learn to use the ECA products.
Can I just pick up on that topic? Because I think that's a really interesting point. And in the previous panel to the one before this one, the gentleman from Investment Relations Manager, no, Investment Relations, no, sorry, this is Adrian Swift, the power guy. He said that they are bringing people from their destination markets into their company to train them up and to give them skills enhancement around their product, but also how they get it financed. And I think, certainly for me, it was only the first time, and now it's the second time, I've heard the word training being used at the conference. And I think that's such a powerful tool when you get it right. If you bring people into an ECA or a bank environment very early in their careers and give them some experience of the product and what it can do, it's a fantastic way, a very powerful way, of spreading the word along with what Gabby's suggesting, in terms of getting it known by more borrowers and familiarized with more borrowers. So
I think we should be swapping staff, like a training basis. So send ECA people to banks and bank people to ECAs, even at the risk of losing them.
We've done that topic. But this was the borrowers coming in from Africa, from Asia, from LATAM, which is even more powerful.
Okay. Well, in terms of training needs, we do also have our ECA training school, CC Solutions. So just a little plug in there. Okay, but one issue, back to the original question around image problem. Now, the biggest image problem that this industry has faced as a challenge has been some of the discourse and conversation around US Exim Bank over the last few years, and how many different opinions there's been on it, how uneducated potentially of the ongoings of that bank many of those opinions have been from, be it the media or with people with a certain perspective. So it just brings an interesting point. What has that taught us in terms of how you now think the product needs to be communicated to a wider group, be it the reputational issue or whatever it is? Has it changed off the back of what's happened with US Exim and the fact that even now there's some people that don't recognize that value that quite often, quite obviously everyone in this room does see?
Yeah, I think I'll start with that, if I may. I think the problem with US Exim, and actually it happened with UK Export Finance for ECGD about 10, 15 years ago when there was that zero option in terms of do we need an export credit agency? And I think the problem being is that notwithstanding, and in both cases were very similar, both agencies were providing a net contribution to the exchequer, but no one really believed them. And there wasn't enough praise coming from the exporters as well as the buyers, i.e. the end users. It became a very financing kind of question. And so therefore, state subsidy to the banks or state subsidy to big exporters wasn't really resonating with Joe Public. So I think the lessons on both counts is that you've got to get industry, the exporters and the buyers, to be saying, look, this is an integral part of the way that we do cross-border trade and the benefits both economically and geopolitically in terms of why we do what we do. Mm. And I think the more that industry are the spokes people for this business, then at a higher level in politics, there's going to be more support.
That and your last word, politics, I think for me is key. I think what's happened in the US tells us absolutely nothing about public opinion on export credit agencies. I don't know what Isabel in the audience would think, but I would guess that 99% of the US population doesn't really know what Exim does. I'd say the same for UKEF. 99% of the UK population doesn't know what UKEF. Doesn't matter. But it tells you everything that you need to know about politics and how it's become a bit of a political football to pop for politicians. So nothing at all about public opinion, I don't think.
I think maybe in a smaller country, which is very much depending on exports, it's a different story. So everyone knows Finnvera. And, if there's, from time to time, there's some criticism that, we're taking these risks, you can see an ordinary person, writing in the social media, but you know, what are you saying? That this is a money-making machine for the taxpayers, so they've not been losing money, they've just been making money for the past 19 years.
Yeah, I mean, when I was on the UK, there was a coal review looking at export finance and what the UK government needs to do to support SMEs and mid-size and to get further growth in the export market from a UK perspective. It was amazing. We found that as soon as you went outside the M25, the knowledge of UK export finance literally fell off a cliff. So it was a London kind of based knowledge base. So the big the manufacturing capabilities outside of London had no knowledge that even UK export finance existed. And so therefore, I think the lesson is to get industry much more heavily involved. And the voice from industry is going to be 20 times more powerful, more weighty to politicians than it is from the banks.
One of our colleagues, the Danish EKF, they went as far as having TV commercials because they wanted to increase the knowledge of the SMEs on
the
EKF.
Was it possibly the best ECA in the world?
Yeah, possibly.
Or Danish.
I mean, I guess on that point, though, I mean, EKF, it does help when your biggest export is renewables as well. I mean, that's quite a nice message. I guess
Possibly, not
all ECAs probably have that.
And I think it is, I think, Toppy's point about the size of the country and the relevance to the country is probably the biggest factor. For the US, if you think about it, it's, you know, one of the biggest countries in the world, biggest population, biggest or second biggest trading nation, exporter, whatever. It's also got the deepest capital markets in the world, an investor base, which means that when something happens like this, it doesn't really impact them on day one. It would be catastrophic for Nokia. Mm-hmm. But it's not necessarily going to be catastrophic in the US. And look what's happened. Has the USA fallen apart? Well, yes, it has, but for other reasons. It's
from our ivory towers, you know.
And what it's led to, as you might imagine, from the US, which is a major, they say, if it sneezes in New York, you catch a cold in the rest of the world, etc. It does impact what's going on. But the fact that Exim hasn't been there, it's just all it's led is to the markets being more creative, and the exporters have been being more creative. They're saying, okay, if Exim isn't going to play, we'll go and play elsewhere. Thank you very much. We're corporations and we need to make a profit and we need to work in the emerging markets. Will it come back? If it doesn't come back, is it going to cause a major problem? Yeah, it could do, but probably not at the end of the day. It won't today, but the markets are liquid. It's a pretty benign market. In fact, the markets are over-liquid. What they need to take care of is if they've shut it down in 3 years' time, when something on the geopolitical or economic scene hits, God forbid another financial crisis, then they'll know the benefit of an export credit agency. Because we have to come, an export credit agency, I still believe that you talk about how can we grow the export credit agency business and how can we attract new borrowers, etc. On the other side, you've got to really reflect on what it's supposed to be there for. And I still do believe that export credit agencies are there to plug market gaps and not to compete with the commercial market. Yeah. But there are gaps in the commercial market, so it does need to be there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but again, if all of the export credit agencies, 60-odd% of the volume is done by 20 exporters, then I think that is a problem for various export credit agencies.
Yeah, but it's not, though, is it?
Well, that's the data, mate.
The data, but if Bechtel does a project in Egypt, there's a supply chain there of 10,000 companies. Right.
And that's the reported data as well, and there's a heck of a lot of new data coming into the market from China and other developed markets that are setting up ECAs, despite the fact that one of the largest ECAs in the world has been on hold. The market's still growing.
People are not interested in the detail, right? Look at the headline about US. They're not. Look at your headline.
That's what you said yesterday.
No. Look at the headline about US Exim. I'm looking at Isabel here to confirm. They were seen as Boeing's bankers. Okay?
And incorrectly.
So they're.
Incorrectly.
But of course it was incorrect, but the fact of the matter is that's how the market and the popular press and Joe Public in the US and Capitol Hill were looking at US exit, Boeing's bankers. And you've got to change that away from being not just Boeing, but everybody else's in terms of exporters. And so therefore, it's back to this image problem. And I think export credit agencies need to address that and get industry speaking more widely about this support.
Yeah, I mean, Toby, how do you measure success in terms of the way you communicate to government, to shareholders? I mean, how is it all about what you return to the taxpayer, or is there more than that?
I think it's, you know, today you really have to measure your impact very systematically, and also it's not good enough if the ECA, for instance, is measuring its own impact. So you need to have a impartial third party confirming your impact. So it is not good enough if we say that we covered so and so much and we earned premium so and so much. So you really have to be able to explain how many jobs you have created, or how many jobs you maintain by helping the company win the contract. So it is challenging, and I think, you know, you are in the end, of course, even if you are self-sustaining, you are taking the risk on the back of the taxpayer, so you are liable to the taxpayer in the end, even if you are making money. So you need to understand your impact. Mm-hmm.
The world is changing as well. We've gone through a period of globalization over the last 15 years, and it's actually, it's reversing, but there's much talk about it reversing. And I think we're going to see some countries are actually, the image problem isn't a problem necessarily. Okay, we have this big issue in the US, but they're looking more to home base and to support exporters. So I think there's a little bit of a counterbalance coming in. So the image problem may not be such of a big image problem. The UK, for instance, look at how different UKEF has performed over the last 3 or 4 years. And partly because, Brexit was announced last June, all of a sudden there was a big rally in the UK, and okay, let's see how we can pull everything together. In Holland, in the Netherlands, you know, they're talking about corralling all the support for the Netherlands, InvestNL, FMO, you know, teaming up with the Atradius and stuff. It's happening.
When you talk about success, you start to talk about what does winning look like and what does losing look like. You know, how do you define what you're doing? And I wrote down a few things that I think would be what winning looks like for our business. So winning would mean having a strong and resilient industry with new joiners in people, but also institutions coming into the market. It means export finance being a part of treasurers and governments' due diligence when they go through their list of potential sources for longer-dated funding. It means products and maybe even platforms for capital markets investors to join the party in a more accessible way, because they clearly want to be here, and there's quite a few of them who've been here the last couple of days. And I think it means new ECAs coming into the market as well, being set up in developing countries, as we were just saying, who recognize the importance of ECAs to help promote their domestic industries. And for me, it means more future interaction with the private sector as well. And people that know me know I've been a big proponent of this over the last few years, and I think the fact that there's been so much of the private sector here suggests to me that that's the right way to go. It'll mean risk is being underwritten correctly and priced correctly, and it'll be a signal that ECAs are more engaged with the way business is done in the private sector. And then you know what losing will look like? Losing will be if we're having this conversation at next year's TXF conference about self-justifying and having to explain about our business. That's what losing will look like.
Okay. Losing might also look like missing the boat, which I've just been informed for you, Simon Sayer, your colleagues are on the dock and you might miss the boat if you don't go in 2 or 3 minutes. So it's,
Are we nearly finished? I've got to go. Okay.
Yeah. Timing
is everything.
I'll take Simon. Just take Simon.
Yeah. Continue. Well, yeah. Okay. Simon, good to see you.
Sorry. I was enjoying that. Thanks.
Yeah. On the question of what does good look like, and I was looking at this from a banker's perspective, and I come up with five, which are basically profitability per headcount in terms of, and also in terms of profitability for assets employed, having impact with key relationships. The third being the ability to cross-sell. We just can't have this business as being one little P&L associated with the export credit loan. It needs to look wider in terms of other ancillary business that the banks can obtain. The fourth is the ability to attract and retain best staff. And the fifth, and I think really most importantly, making sure that you have operational success. And I think the operational risk, going back to this complexity, if a bank starts to have operational failures, it puts a question mark on their total capabilities for the, all of their ECA business. And I think operational success is really a very large bomb that the banks need to concentrate on to make sure that they don't fail on that, because it can be quite catastrophic.
Okay. All right. Any further comments on that, Simon or Toppy?
I would very much agree. I think, you know, it's of course our business has been getting much more complicated. When I think that when I joined, we had country risk specialists, and we had underwriters, and we had claims and recoveries people. So today, we of course we still have these, but you know we have reinsurance specialists, we have KYC specialists, we have environmental analysts, we have you know social impact analysts,
compliance,
and so forth, compliance officers, so forth and so on. So it is, and of course all this we need to have to avoid the operational risks.
Mm-hmm. And the bit I just never understood is why the export credit agencies insist on getting heavily involved in the documentation aspects, because they should be saying, in my opinion, you've got credit support for this particular transaction so long as these reps and warranties and covenants are included into the loan agreement, and then they should say to the lawyers, it's your role to make sure the documentation is undertaken within that parameter, and therefore free the export credit agencies from getting heavily involved in documentation, which I think is just slows the whole process down. Most of these transactions are done by external lawyers. Why not just delegate it to them?
You agree with that?
But it's a small print in the liability insurance of the London lawyers that's really causing the fact that you know you cannot really only rely on the London lawyer.
Okay. I think a lot of banks do put a great deal of store by the fact that the agencies, whether they're taking documentation risk or not, the agencies do take an interest in the end result.
Yeah, and you can manage that. Have a panel and just say, you law firms, you're eligible to be on the panel, but if there is a documentation error that has manifested itself at a later point in time, the risk on you, Mr. Lawyer, is you're no longer on the panel. So I think there's ways of managing this. You don't have to have all of this process where a lot of export credit agencies do not have the skill set, in my opinion, which is greater than the lawyers. So if that's the case, it's just a process which is grinding things to a very slow snail's pace, which I think is often one of the biggest distractors by borrowers. And you know, we need to be aware that our business has to compete with other forms of debt raising.
Of course, in the ideal world, we would all be working based on standardized documentation, but then in the end, you have the borrowers who also have very strict opinions on you know how the document has to look like and how exactly the wording of the covenant has to be reading. So I think this is a major challenge that we cannot really work enough based on standardized documentation. But there are some ECAs who are better with this than others. And I think you know UK Export Finance very much using the standardized document, for instance. So, but at the same time, I would assume that some of the clients may be complaining that it's not easy to work with them because we cannot have our language in the document.
Yeah. Religion again.
Yeah. I was going to say, is there any questions from the floor? There is there's lots of questions from the floor. So microphone coming round. I think, well, Clarissa first, I guess, and then in the middle, and then Charlie over here. So. Yeah, that's good. Go.
We've seen the big measure for me was the volume, especially with the SME element of ECA-supported deals. And we used to see that data as well, and I think that's a very important thing. Hermes are very proud of their work with SMEs, and perhaps looking at some of that as well as the overall, just to deal with your point about the misperception of the Boeing Bank thing. They also did publish the 90% of the transactions done by US Exim Bank were little ones, were the SME ones, weren't they? I think that's my from memory. And of course now they're down to 10 million a pop. They'll be going on doing that. And I think one shouldn't underestimate the contribution to the global economy from the work that continues, the very good work that continues, supporting SMEs.
Okay, all right, thank you. So we have a question sort of here in the middle as well. So.
Is it working?
Yeah, it's on. Yeah.
It's working, yes. Thank you. To begin with, of course, I would like to compliment FinVer, of course, to begin with. We started our business in India focused on ECA. We have, of course, we've been in India for the last 25 years. The export credit business we picked up as a niche activity only around 2 years ago. We worked with various agencies. And by far, I would say we started working with FinVer on a transaction around 2 years ago. This transaction got delayed because of the client, not because of FinVer. And the people at FinVer were very good to pick it up again. And of course, we've had a wonderful experience with them. I'd like to compliment you for that. That's the first thing.
Thank you.
We have in this process, because we are new to this entire engagement, we have in this process experienced certain specific characteristics. One, of course, is that the borrower needs to mandate a bank to approach an ECA and, of course, to process a transaction with an ECA. This is a typical requirement. Isn't there a possibility that this is extended to boutique investment banks or to advisory firms like us who can be impaneled in the ECAs and then we could be mandated because we do nearly the same work what a bank is going to do, except that we approach multiple banks who could give us the right kind of a spread, because spread differs from a bank to bank. An understanding of the transaction and understanding of the demographics in the country, the local situations, differ from bank to bank. In this particular transaction that we've been working with you, KfW IPEX is our banker. So we're very happy working with them, for sure. But at the same point in time, there could be other transactions, there could be maybe interesting deals where we could be looking to work with maybe two banks or three banks, and the borrower cannot take a decision which bank he would like to work with until the last day or maybe just before that. I appreciate that, yes, there are a lot of decisions, a lot of discussions that ECA has to have hand in hand with the bankers. So if this can be considered, if this can be also one of the ways in which you can engage with investment banks and boutique firms in various countries, besides what was being suggested, that a lot of work can be outsourced, including the documentation process to third parties.
May I comment? I think, yes, we are not a direct lender. If you work with an ECA who's a direct lender, they might not need a bank. We need a bank who we know that can manage the export credit. So typically, we are not working with banks who are not capable of running the credit for the whole credit period and also doing all the collection actions and so forth if need be. So we are not working with small investment banks, unfortunately. Then also, of course, the other thing is that we try to make sure that there's no conflict of interest. So we don't want to see that a loan covered by us is used for repaying the bank's other loans. That's, in a way, the simple explanation for why we are doing like this. But if we were a direct lender, yes, definitely we could do it without the bank, with you, but we still are not.
I'm trying to explain to you is that a bank with whom the borrower is willing to work, there is, of course, he's going to manage the export credit. The bank is going to, of course, be the first lender. You will be a guarantor. You will cover it. But when we speak with the borrower, he could have two or three options. And he would like to keep those options alive until he has a final sanction from you.
But that works already. You can do that. I mean, I run a business which does exactly that. I'm not a bank. I'm an ECA advisor. I support clients all the way through that process with different export credit agencies, different financial institutions. And when we get to a point in time where there's a heads of agreement, then at that point in time, we appoint a bank. And you can do that. But you have to be very clear. The difference between the role as an advisor
absolutely
and the role of a bank. And we got to this point, which is advising, when we need a bank, and I fully agree that, you know, the export credit agencies need to understand that they're dealing with banks who have the operational capability and have the infrastructure to manage this religion of export credit agency business, which they have their panel of banks which are able to execute this type of
transaction. Fully agree with you.
And that works.
So the mandate is not required day one, because this is what...
You have to be careful what your mandate is. If your mandate is to do the advisory and arranging, then you're going to run into problems. If your mandate is to advise and then select a bank who is eligible to do this export credit agency business, then, believe you me, that's a business model.
Great.
Okay.
And, thank you.
Charlie, did you have a question as well? One more. And we'll make this final question, I think.
Okay, yeah. I just want to quickly... Charlie Welsh from iCor. Great session, very interesting, and I love the podcast, big fan. I just want to pick up on something you said, Gabby. I'm not sure it was in your five marks, but you said, we have to speed up the deliverable. And it made me think of something that was said on the Middle East panel yesterday, and it went something like this. It was a government, somebody who worked for a government body in the United Arab Emirates, and he said that there's a need for differentiation and quality, overall ability of presenting offering. And he said ECAs, European ECAs, have to present that holistic picture, awareness of the contractors. ECAs, they're unfamiliar with the contractors and relevant suppliers, whereas the Chinese present a comprehensive package. I'm not saying that the Chinese are doing it right. They have to appoint the EPC. EPC has to be Chinese. I think that's problematic. But I mean that comment.
That comment resonates. I mean, it's international trade. When you're at, well, actually more so when you're at an SME market, you need answers really quickly. You can't wait 3 months to know whether an export credit agency is going to provide support. So, there are issues where I remember once waiting a year for an ECA to come up with a premium. Now, my borrower at that point gave up the will to live after a month. But actually, we were just quite interested to see how long this ECA took to come up with a premium rate, a year. At the moment, we're still waiting sometimes 4 months to get an LOI from particular ECAs for a sovereign-backed facility. And I'm going, look, it's on your list. You pre-agreed a limit. It's Ministry of Finance guarantee. Now, what do you want me to do? Point to where the country is? You should be able to provide an LOI quickly, not 3 or 4 months. And I think the agency's got to realise that exporters and buyers have the ability to look at different countries in terms of buying particular pieces of equipment and goods and services in general. And if an agency is slower than another, and the Chinese are very good about providing a holistic package.
Some of the smaller ECAs, like Finnvera, we are very quick in writing love letters, so we do it in a couple of hours.
Yeah, and that is how it should be. right? And that's responding to the needs, the commercial needs of exporting and importing.
Okay, well, look, I'm going to end it there as a tour from Bibles through to love letters. Thank you very much.